Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Ecclesiastes chapter 10. I'm going to go through chapter 10 a little quicker for a couple of reasons. I will be gone Wednesday, and Brother Owen will be teaching the class. I'll be gone next Sunday, and Brother David Smitherman will be here for all three lessons next Sunday. And the following Wednesday is singing. And also, chapter 10 is a continuation of what we have been discussing in 7, 8, and 9. So, Lord willing, 2 weeks from today, we will pick up in chapters 11 and 12, and I want to cover those together. We'll have about 4 class periods, maybe 5 left in the book of Ecclesiastes. I want to touch on the Songs of Solomon and then move into the book of Isaiah. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 3. If you want a quick overview of what is the book of Ecclesiastes all about, Solomon, once he introduces himself in the first 2 verses, he tells you what the book is about. And here's what he says in chapter 1 and verse 3. What advantage does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? The phrase "under the sun," we've talked about it a lot, occurs 31 times, and it means while you're breathing, under the sun, while you're on this earth or in this life. So the question is, when you've finished seeing all the things you're going to see, hearing all the things you're going to hear, meeting all the people you're going to meet, buying all the stuff you're going to buy, playing with every toy in life, and your life is over, what is left? What advantage is there? And he says it is a natural thing to try to break the monotony of life, and that's why he talks about in verse 4 and beyond, a generation comes and a generation goes. The rivers flow into the ocean. The ocean doesn't fill up. The wind keeps blowing. It blows the next day. Then he goes on to say in verse 8, all things are wearisome. The latter part of verse 9, is there anything new under the sun? He says in verse 10, see, this is new. Well, it may be new to you, but it's been in here for long generations past. He begins talking about all of the things that he tried in his life, buying stuff, seeing stuff, going places, acquiring, listening to music, money. And he says in verse 17, I hated life. I hated the work of my hands because what had been done under the sun was grievous to me. Why was it grievous? Because he couldn't take it with him and he was worried about who he was going to leave it to. He introduces God in chapter 2 and verse 24. And for the first time, he says, I learned how to have things make sense to me. In verse 24, there is nothing better for a man to do and eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. Verse 25, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting. I want you to go to the 7th chapter. So chapters 1 through 6 is his raw data. I've spent most of my life as a researcher. 20 years at Dow Chemical and almost 24 years working for myself. What you see is you collect data, collect data, collect data, and you start seeing similarities, and you start trying to put all this together. So then from that, you start putting together your final product. His final product is this. You want to know what advantage there is under the sun of all the work that you do? Chapter 7 and verse 1 says, a good name is better than a good ointment. And the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. That's what he tells you. That's where he starts, and he's going to finish this in the end of chapters 12 when he says, this is the whole duty of man, is to fear God and to keep his commandments. We're going to look at ointment this morning in just a moment in chapter 10. How do I keep focused on my reputation? My reputation is the most important thing I have. He said you need to begin with the end in mind. You need to begin with staying in a house of mourning. It's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting. Why? Because it's the end of every man, and the living take it to heart. He says it is more valuable, more beneficial for you to be around those who are mourning than those who are playing or feasting. And looking at chapter 8, he talks about, I don't care how wealthy you are, how powerful you are, the biggest king, the greatest president, the greatest prime minister, that person is still under God's control. They don't know what their future holds, and they do not know the day of their death. Like any human being, they do not know. And that's what he says in chapter 8, in verse 8. No man has authority to restrain the wind with the wind or authority over the day of his death. In chapter 9, we talked about the value of wisdom, the value of wisdom in your life. And he says in chapter 9, he talks about people making foolish decisions and how those decisions impact them. He finishes up by looking at this in verse 5. What's important is the living know something. Those who are alive in Christ know something that spiritual dead do not. What is it?
They'll die.
They'll die. And we had a good conversation about, well, wait a minute, everybody knows they're going to die. Well, yeah, everybody knows they're going to die, sort of, kind of. Except Howard Hughes, he wasn't going to die. He refused to go to funerals. Everybody laughs and says he went to one. People will say, how much money did Howard Hughes leave? I can remember when I was 30 years old, maybe, something like that. There was our kind of articles in the paper. How much money did he leave? How much money did he leave? One preacher said he left every bit of it. None of it went with him. So the difference is, those who are alive in Christ know they're going to die, and they focus on it. And those who don't kind of know they're going to die, but they don't want to think about it. I want to put it out of my brain. I want to play more. I want to go more. I want to see more things. Solomon says, pardon me, in verse 7, 8, and 9, there were four things that he said you ought to learn to do in your time under the sun. Number one, in verse 7, go then, eat your bread in happiness, and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has approved your works. So he's going to add this to verse 8. Enjoy what you have. There is a tendency for us to assume that we have many more years. I'm 60 years old. Beyond 60, but I'm using that as an example. And I know I got 20, 25 more years, right? Everybody knows that. Look how many 80-year-olds are here. I know for sure I have 20 more years at least, right? So this is what James says, you boast in arrogance. So too much planning. We need to plan. We need to plan for our future. We need to plan for various things. But too much of that means you don't enjoy what you have, and you're betting on the fact that you're going to have more years, and you may or may not. Verse 8, he says, let your clothes be white all the time. We spent a good bit of time talking about that. Your relationship with the Lord. Look at the end of 7. For God has already approved your work. You're going to see him say the same thing when he talks about young people. Young people, don't be worried. Don't fret. Go enjoy your life. However, understand that God is going to hold you in account for what you do. So he, in this text, enjoy yourself in things that God has approved. In verse 8, let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. That is, enjoy your life, but have a relationship with the Lord. Be clean with him. Verse 9, enjoy life with the woman which you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun, for this is your reward in life, in your toil which you have. Family. Maybe you have a husband or wife. Maybe you don't. You've got children. You've got grandchildren, nieces and nephews. Verse 10, whatever your hands find to do, do verily with all your might, for there is no activity or planning or wisdom in Sheol where you're going. Then he begins talking about, we just spent some time on this, time and chance. So he says, not only do you know you're going to die, but you also know that you don't have any control over your future. You can plan, and planning is good. But the race is not always won to the swiftest. The warrior, the strongest warrior, doesn't always win. The person that's the smartest doesn't always have the most money. And he begins talking about those. In verse 16, "So I said, wisdom is better than strength, because the wisdom of the poor man is despised and his words are not heeded. The words of a wise man heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler amongst fools." Then he says, wisdom is better than weapons. So it's better than great strength and it's better than weapons. I'm going to tell you why in just a moment. But the latter part of verse 18 is almost like a hinge that fits into verse 11. And that is, but one sinner destroys much good. One sinner destroys much good. I want you to think about this for a moment. My favorite soup in the world has been for a long time and still is clam chowder. I love clam chowder. I'm quite the connoisseur. I have eaten thousands of bowls of clam chowder. I've eaten them all around the world. I've eaten them from the East Coast to the West Coast and every restaurant in Texas, I think. So one day, I get this big, beautiful bowl of kind of creamy colored clam chowder, and there's a tiny little black speck in it. And I think it's probably a pepper or something, you know, that they didn't get mixed up. So I get in there with my fork and I fish it out. And what do you think it was? A fly. A fly. But naturally, I said, well, the fly didn't swim over the whole thing. And so I just pick it out and I'll go ahead and eat my bowl, right? So for 3,000 years, one fly in a large, beautiful container of ointment that's expensive, or a big, beautiful bowl of soup, and the whole bowl of soup is ruined, right? Look at what he says in chapter 10 and verse 1. Dead flies make the perfumer's oil stink. A little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. I want to come back to that in a moment. As we tie in the latter part of chapter 9 coming into chapter 10 and verse 1. Let's, Brother Owen, will you lead us in prayer? I was going to say something else, but I think I'll break here for a second.
Our dear God, thank you for wisdom and your word. Understanding how you function, how you think, and how you would have us function. We pray, Father, that you will open our hearts to our truth.
Amen. So all the way back to chapter 7 and verse 1, through the end of chapter 10, we're going to put these together, we learn that what value, what profit, or what advantage does a man have under the sun? Chapter 7 and verse 1, he says, a good name. That's what you take with you. That's why when you take a look at Matthew chapter 6, Matthew chapter 5, rather, where Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, you don't store up for yourselves things on this earth where moss can destroy and rust can destroy and thieves break through and steal, but rather, he says, store up for yourselves things in heaven where those things don't happen. Revelation 14 and 13, we looked at this, I quoted it last week. Blessed are they that die in the Lord, beloved, from now on, that they shall rest from their labors, and their deeds follow after them. So when you begin looking at life as being something bigger than 60 or 70 or 80 years, you look at the part of you that's you. The part of you that God came, sent angels down to get in the case of Lazarus in Luke 16 is a lot bigger, is infinitely bigger than what happens on this earth. And a good name is the most important thing that you have. And your life on this earth, the day of your death is better than the day of your birth, meaning that you did something. Your life stood for something. How important is your reputation? And how fragile is it? What can destroy a 40 or 50 or 60 year reputation? One fly in the ointment. One fly in the soup. Now when I began looking at, I'm learning from Solomon that my reputation is more important than my job, than my relationship to the mayor of the city or the governor or the president. This is what we're going to talk about in just a moment. Things that oftentimes cause people to compromise their values, to compromise or lose their composure. That's where we're headed in just a moment. Would you agree with me that one fly in your ointment will cost you dearly in your reputation? You have children that you raise up, and you've done a pretty good job. But every single time as your children get older, you want to correct them in a pretty stern way. They're going to say, "But Daddy, I remember when you did this." That's why the fly in the ointment or the fly in the soup is so important. That's why one mistake of any significance will cost you the rest of your life, and you'll have to try to constantly recoup from it. If you're trying to get a job and you're filling out your resume and you had one really bad situation with a job, and so you don't put that on your resume, maybe the next boss finds it and maybe they don't. I have known, I bet you Ashley has too and some others, people that were escorted out because a year or two later they lied on their application. They left some important piece of information out. The rails, like a train that runs up and down the track over here, the rails that we run on in our life is, if you believe with all your heart, you've come there to believe that your reputation, your name is the most important thing you have, and it's the only thing that will be here when you're gone, and it's the only thing you take with you to heaven, it will cause you to look a lot more closely and a lot more seriously at every word you say, everything you do, how you handle yourself in public. Now look in the next couple of verses. Verse 2 and 3, I want you to look at this. This is chapter 10 of Ecclesiastes, verse 2 and 3. A wise man's heart directs him toward the right, but a foolish man's heart directs him toward the left. Even when the fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking and he demonstrates to everyone that he is a fool. I want you to think about a couple of things. One of the challenges for a fool or for a person lacking wisdom is this. Would you agree with me that your brain is going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? How many of you have become aware that you will wake up in the middle of the next morning and there's a song that you're singing? Or that there's something that you obviously have been thinking about the whole night. So your brain doesn't turn off at night. In my 34 years, and I'd venture to guess Scott's had the same situation, you're struggling with how do you deal with a situation or how do you handle a particular person. And I wake up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I've got an entire sermon worked out in my brain. You ever had that happen before? Chapter 10, verse 2 and 3. 10, 2 and 3. So what I would tell you is this. As I'm walking down the road, as I'm just going through my normal phase of life where I don't really have time to stop and say, let me call my best friend, let me call the smartest person I know. Your brain is clicking off things and you're saying things and you're responding to things and you're thinking about things. So he says in verse 3, even when you're walking down the road, a fool apparently is a fool. A Everybody can even tell it when he's just walking down the road, because we're making decisions on a regular basis, and the decisions have impact on us. What we say, how we respond, how we dress, how we act. It's interesting how many times, twice in the book of Proverbs, Solomon looked out his window and he saw a woman dressed like a harlot. Is there a particular way that harlots dress? Solomon thought so. So you see that there are things that happen. He talks about the ant, how the ant stores things up because he knows there's going to be winter time coming. If I'm not making any plans for the future, what verse 3 says is he knows that he is a fool. Now here's something else that I want you to think about. In looking at this, I want you to turn with me to two Old Testament stories for a minute. The book of Joshua, the 7th chapter. Joshua chapter 7, how is it that one fly makes an entire bowl of soup worthless? How is it that in a person's reputation, one mistake, one significant mistake is gigantic? In the 6th chapter of the book of Joshua, we have the story of the walls of Jericho falling down. They marched around the city 7 times and they shouted and they blew their horns and the walls came tumbling down. That's what the song says when I was a little kid. And we have a song in our book that says the walls came tumbling down. There's something very important that that story doesn't tell you. And what it doesn't tell you is the city was under a ban. This would be the first city as they crossed the Jordan River. So Moses has died. They mourned for him 30 days. Joshua was told by God, blow the horn, get them up, boys. We're going across the river. The first city they came to was Jericho. And they were told, everything here of value belongs to God. The gold, the silver, the precious jewels, and all the other things. So they understood that, except one man. In chapter 7, in verse 1, this is Joshua chapter 7, a man by the name of Achan, who was a distant cousin to Moses, decided, what difference is going to make? What difference will it make? I'm going to take some important few pieces of gold, a few pieces of things right here, and I'm going to hide it under my tent, and nobody's going to be the better for the or the worse for it. I'm just going to take a little bit for myself. So the next day, they go to the second battle, and it is a city called Ai, just A and I. And this is a smaller town, no fortified city. And so they go and they say, we don't need to take everybody, we're going to take a small contingent. And they got slaughtered. And when they came running back with their tail between their legs, Joshua couldn't believe it. I want you to look at what verse 6, chapter 7 and verse 6. Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until evening, both he and the elders of the city, and they put dust on their heads. And Joshua said, alas, O Lord God, why didst thou even bring the people over the Jordan to deliver them from the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? Now Joshua didn't know that this little fly was in the ointment. He didn't know it. God says, Verse 10, the Lord said to Joshua, rise up. Why is it you have fallen on your face? Israel has sinned. That's why the problem has occurred, and they have transgressed my covenant. Therefore, verse 12, the sons of Israel cannot stand before their enemies, for they turn their back for their enemies. And basically God says, I'm going to destroy them because of it. I'm going to move on because of time. In verse 14, Joshua is told, you go in, I'm going to help you figure out what tribe of the 12 tribes. Then I'm going to help you find out what family. And then I'm going to help you find out what person, what individual. And it came to a man by the name of Achan. In verse 19... Verse 19 and 20, as for the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord, that's what they were told. It was for the treasury. If you take a look in verse 24, they They burned the city with fire and all of it, only the silver and gold and articles of bronze. I'm on the wrong chapter. Maybe that's why Shelby had trouble. Chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 19. Joshua said to Achan, "My son, I implore you, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give praise to him, and tell us now what you have done. Do not hide it from me." So Achan answered Joshua and said, "Truly I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel, and this is what I did." And he begins talking about all the stuff that he took and he hid. Verse 24, Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, the silver, the mantle, the bar of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, all that belonged to him, and they brought it up before the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." And all Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire. And after they had stoned them with the stones, they raised over him a great heap of stone that stands to this day. And the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore the place was called the valley of Achor to this day. Did a fly in the ointment in this situation make a problem? One foolish man, this is what the end of chapter 9 said, a foolish man can do much harm. In 2 Kings chapter 21, 2 Kings chapter 21, the man that we've talked about a couple of times, that he made a mistake. Because he lost his faith and his composure, he went into the temple and began ripping the gold off and sending it to the Assyrian king, Sennacherib. His name was Hezekiah. Because he prayed to God, God gave him another 15 years. And he did good in that 15 years. But he had a son after him who was the worst king of all of the kings. Anybody know what his name was? Manasseh. And Manasseh reigned 50 years. He basically brought this nation down. They never recovered. Now, I'm not going to go through much detail, but in chapter 21 and verse 1, he was 12 years old. And you can see verse 3, he rebuilt the high place that Hezekiah's father had destroyed. He created all the altars of Baal and made an Ashtaroth, and the Arab kings of Israel had done, and worshipped the host of Israel. Now, you can go through all of this, but God says, because of one bad king, they had 18 kings. 18 kings of the southern kingdom, 9 were considered good, 9 were considered bad. This one king out of 18 basically brought this nation so low they could not recover. Now I want you to go back with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and then 10. Look in chapter 9 and verse 18. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. I just gave you two quick stories where one sinner caused great harm, not to themselves, but to everybody else around them. And a little bit of foolishness, a little bit of slip on our part, as he says in chapter 10 and verse 1, can destroy a person's reputation. I have had this said back to me more times than I can tell you, but I'm going to just ask it in the form of a question. Do you believe, generally speaking, a person will accept the gospel from someone they don't respect? Now you ought to say, what difference does that make? Well, the truth is the truth, right? And somebody's preaching, and they're teaching the truth, and they're teaching a good lesson, but the majority of the people they're preaching to don't respect that person. That's why when you get to the point in your life where you say, my reputation, my name is more important than anything on earth. Now I'm going to tell you two things very quickly that cause us to have difficult times. And he talks about this in the next two sections. Verse 4. If a ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position because your composure allays great offenses. And he goes on talking about oftentimes kings or people in authority will hire the wrong people. They'll hire bad people. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. Verse 5, there's an evil I've seen under the sun, an error that goes forth from rulers. Folly is set in the exalted places while rich people sit in humble places. I've seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like the slave of the land. The idea being, when I am in confrontation, my boss gets angry with me. I have something going on with some government agency or the king. Two things tend to happen. Number one, I begin crawfishing on what I really believe. I begin to change a little bit and back off a little bit of what I believe and what I've told people I believe. Do you think that that matters? To your kids, grandkids, great-grandkids, to your friends? Secondly, if I get angry, I lose my composure. What is the probability that I'm going to say things and do things I really wish I hadn't done? I want to give you a couple of quick examples. The book of Daniel. This is one thing I want you to think about. We have stories of, this is Daniel chapter 1 I want to go to. We have stories of several, I'm going to say five, young Hebrew children that were grabbed and pulled away from their parents when they were children. That would be Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Esther. Now I'm going to tell you this. These parents, these Hebrew parents, did these kids right. Because in five out of five cases, when they were asked to compromise a little bit what you were taught, compromise what you believe, they didn't get ugly. They didn't confront them. They just said, no, thank you, no, thank you, no, thank you. You've studied the story of Esther. Esther, we want to give you all this special ointments and all these special... No, thank you. Let me just have what I have. I want you to look in Daniel chapter 1. So you remember they wanted to teach these kids all kinds of things. This is chapter 1 and verse 4. Youth and no defect who were good looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and so forth. So they wanted to change their names. They wanted to change their food. They wanted to change their culture. They wanted to change who they were as people so they fit in to the Babylonian world. Here's what verse 11, chapter 1 and verse 11. Daniel said to the overseer whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Who are those three? That would be Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego after their names were changed. Daniel's name was changed to Belteshazzar, similar to Nebuchadnezzar's son. Verse 12. Please test your servants for 10 days and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence, the appearance of youth who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in the matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. In verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge. God gave them, not Nebuchadnezzar and his people, gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Verse 20, as for every matter of wisdom and understanding which the king consulted them, he found them to be 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers that were in his realm. What I'm going to tell you is this. Daniel was polite. He was kind. He never lost his composure. But he also never lost his conviction. I want you to look in the third chapter. Chapter 3. What happens when the king gets angry and he's demanding, or your boss, or the owner of your business, or whoever is demanding that you do certain things, your parents maybe, if they're not godly people. Look at what happens here. This is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar in rage and anger gave the order to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these four men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up?" Now he goes on to tell them, "You just see if your God can deliver you like I can." Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship your golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with rage, and he said, "Make it seven times hotter." Now this is what I want to talk about. Did these young boys lose their cool? Did they ever lose their composure? Did they ever, for one second, compromise who they were? No. And you can see the book of Esther is the same. I want to spend just about 2 minutes. Things done in haste. Things done in haste that you don't contemplate. You don't think about. You don't use prudence. He gives you four examples in verse 8. "He who digs a pit may fall into it, and a serpent may bite him who breaks through the wall." I was told a story by several of you about a wonderful young businessman in Sweeney that burned himself very badly. And Manus was telling me how that happened. How many of you know that story? He was making a fire to cook, I think. Is that right? And stumbled and fell backwards in it. That's a pretty freak thing, isn't it? But it happens. In verse 9, "He who quarries a stone may be hurt by them." I'm picking up heavy things and I'm tearing down a wall. The latter part of verse 8, "Or a serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall." You're busting out a wall and there's a snake there. Saturday morning, we're sitting at La Casona in West Columbia, and it's taking a little while for our food to get to us. And one of the managers comes out and he says to me, "I got a question for you." "Yeah. What do you do if you find a rattlesnake?" Now that's not generally something that you get asked at breakfast. It wasn't a rattlesnake, it was a copperhead. But so they're picking up the rug in the kitchen, and there's a copperhead. Now look at verse 8. "A serpent may bite you who breaks through a wall. He who quarries a stone may be hurt by them, and he who splits the log may be endangered by them." Now the idea being very simple is, I'm busting into something without thinking about it. I'm not using composure. I'm not using prudence, wisdom. I'm not backing up and saying, "Wait a minute, now let me think about this for just a minute." If I look back in my lifetime, the things that I did in haste that cost me, I could fill this board up and erase it and fill it up again. That's a common thing that causes people to lose their composure or oftentimes to compromise who they are because of pressure from somebody above you or because of not thinking through things very clearly. In verse 10, "If an axe is dull, he who sharpens its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage." The old story about the young woodchopper, he chopped so much wood one day that everybody was just amazed. They couldn't believe it. And the next day he went out and he worked even harder and he chopped about the same amount. And the next day he worked harder and he chopped less wood. And he worked harder the fourth day and he chopped less wood. And the old woodcutter comes to him and says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I don't know, I'm working hard as I can." He says, "When's the last time you sharpened your axe?" And he said, "I don't have time for that." You know the story. Sometimes backing up, not barreling headlong into a situation, backing up, taking a break, sharpening your axe will help you immensely in your lifetime. Any comments or questions? We're going to just stop right there. is a story that our president has used on the trail about this woman that found a half-frozen snake and brought the snake in and warmed it up. What did the snake eventually do? Bit her. And she says, "But I saved your life. Why did you kill me?" And the snake says, "You knew I was a snake when you brought me in." Look at verse 11. "If the serpent bites before being charmed, there is no profit for the charmer." If you have the ability to charm a snake, you ought to do it. Thank you for your time. We will pick up, Lord willing, chapter 11, 2 weeks.